So, Pete.
Yep. What is it this week?
Yes. What would you say your sense of adventure is, scale of 1 to 10?
I'd love to be a 10, but I'm actually probably more of a 6. I'd love to do a lot of things, but I'm a little bit afraid.
Have you skydived?
God, no. Are you kidding me?
No, nor have I. Have you climbed a mountain?
No, but that's something I think I could handle, climbing a mountain. What's the hard part is the thin air.
Yeah, the oxygen. We're not talking Everest here. I know there's a couple of hills near me that I will tackle first.
Yes.
If money was no object, would you go to space?
Of course. Space, no brainer. That's a dream of mine and probably the least risky of the three that we've mentioned here.
Yeah, and I would agree. And for me too, I would say there's no question I would love to go to space. But if you had asked me before what would be the thing that could prevent me from going to space, in a safety sort of perspective, I would have said the rocket launch. Like for me, that was always...
So that's not space. That's still here on Earth.
Yeah, but getting there was the impediment. I'd really like to be there, but where I was concerned before was, you know, the danger was the potential that happens with rockets, etc. But what if you could get there without launching a rocket and you could just essentially float into space? How does that sound?
Like a wormhole type thing?
No, it's actually, it's very here on Earth and it's actually happening right now. And the person that would be able to help us understand this better, the what if question today, which is what if you rode a balloon to space? Really, maybe the only people in the world that could answer this question. We have one of them right now. He is the co-CEO and founder of Space Perspective, Tabor McCallan. Tabor, welcome to What If Discussed.
Thank you. This is a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun for us because really, honestly, I mean, we didn't really know about this possibility until very recently. And of course, here at What If, we love to entertain these incredible hypotheticals, but this is probably categorized as less hypothetical and more imminent.
It's happening.
Give us some sort of background a little bit on Space Perspective and what it's all about.
Sure. So Space Perspective is developing Spaceship Neptune, which will take 8 people and a pilot to sort of essentially the edge of space, about 30 kilometers or 20 miles up, using a huge balloon the size of a football stadium. So in essence, what we do is take a capsule up with a balloon big enough to float on top of the Earth's atmosphere, sort of the way an ice cube floats on top of a glass of water, and then float there for a few hours, and then gently float back down and splash down in the ocean and get picked up just like the SpaceX capsule does.
So we're never actually like making it into orbit and in danger of getting like whisked away into space and disappearing forever?
Right. So we don't... So when you fly a rocket to orbit, then you're going so fast that you essentially keep missing the Earth. You're always sort of flying around the Earth. If you go up on a Virgin rocket or a Blue Origin rocket, you go up and then sort of parabolically fall back down. And what we do is we go up and then sort of float there slowly and then gently come back down. So a big part of that experience is actually the slow ascent and slow descent. So when you talk to a pilot or even an astronaut, you know, the getting into orbit part or the getting into space part is so fast, you don't really have time to understand, sort of mentally grasp what's going on. But we take 2 hours to get up there. We're going at 12 miles an hour. So this is like bicycling speed to the edge of space.
Wow.
And we flew Alan Eustace, who was a Google executive, on several flights. He skydived back down, different scenario, but his experience was really interesting. When he describes it, he says, I was there at the launch site and, you know, I could see pebbles on the ground and then we released and he could see, you know, people's feet and then people, the runway, the airport, the town, the surrounding geography, canyons nearby, all for a couple of hours, very slowly. He said, what was interesting was that his brain could keep up with the scale change going on. So by the time he saw the curvature of the Earth, he knew how big the Earth was.
That is so cool. We actually just talked to your partner, Jane Poynter, a while back, and she was punctuating the idea of the perspective part of space perspective. And like you mentioned, it's kind of the transformational impact of seeing the Earth from space, just as described by astronauts. Is this really the ultimate idea of your company, is to give people a better perspective of where they are?
Exactly. I mean, it's... we talk to astronauts and we hear these amazing stories and they make me jealous as heck. Yeah. About that perspective that they get. And it's a little bit like the perspective that Jane and I had inside Biosphere 2, because we knew the size of our little world. We built in the 90s something called Biosphere 2, which was a closed ecosystem that we lived in for 2 years. With all of our food and air and water. So it was our own little world with six other people. Another story for another What If, maybe. Yes. But that well sort done. Of gave us a perspective of knowing how big your world is. And when we talk to astronauts, we often get that, you know, a sense of how getting a grasp of how big our Earth is and sort of how far away everything else is. And I think that's an important experience for people to have, a valuable experience for people to have, and something that I certainly wouldn't want to live my life on this planet, never having seen it as a planet in space.
Wow, you and me both. That is a perfect way to say that. And now I am also jealous and going to see what I can do to be one of those eight on the initial flight. We'll see how this goes. The science you touched on a little bit. But you know, thankfully we have a pretty sophisticated, appetite for science with the What If, community. So drill down a little deeper, if you will, what is actually happening here? Because it does feel like obviously we're kind of going back in time in terms of technology, but what is actually happening to get that balloon safely from the ground into space?
Okay. So you want, this is the geek out moment.
You got it.
Awesome. Okay. So. Most people don't understand how buoyancy works, and it's an amazing thing. So the way buoyancy works is that the atmospheric pressure on the surface of the Earth is higher than the atmospheric pressure a foot above it, which is higher than the atmospheric pressure a foot above it. And so as you go higher, the atmospheric pressure gets lower. So if you make a balloon and you make that volume less dense than the atmospheric pressure around it, that says, so we do that by filling it with helium or hydrogen. The atmospheric pressure at the bottom of that balloon is less than the outside atmospheric pressure. So essentially what's happening is the atmospheric pressure at the bottom of the balloon is pushing it up because it's less than the atmospheric pressure at the top of the balloon.
Hmm.
And so that pressure gradient is what makes buoyancy. So we make this big ball, and it expands as the pressure goes down to get more and more area for that atmospheric pressure to push up on it. And we ascend until we're essentially, in essence, sort of resting on top of the atmosphere, somewhat by analogy. But it's that gradient in atmospheric pressure that makes for how buoyancy works. And so what you need is just a big balloon. And it's somewhat counterintuitive, but we can all test this ourselves in a really fun way.
Hmm.
If you go in there, get in your car and get a helium balloon, and if you're in the car, the helium balloon will be sitting on the roof of the car, right? Because it's inside with you. So you're going along, say, 60 miles an hour, and you hit the brakes. What will happen is that the mass of air in the cabin of the car will be decelerated, so it'll be pushed forward and it'll be more dense in the front than the back, and the balloon will shoot backwards.
Huh.
So we can all just get a balloon, stick it in your car, go hit the brake or hit the accelerator, either way, and the balloon will go the opposite direction of the acceleration of the car because you're changing the gradient of atmospheric pressure in the cabin of your car. So buoyancy is... Look, this goes back to Archimedes, right? It's an old idea. Yeah. How buoyancy works, right? This is our oldest form of flight. And it's difficult because it's counterintuitive. It's tricky because as these big balloons expand and the temperatures of the air you go through, it's its own area of science, really. We don't teach it much because we learned aerodynamic flight with planes and we learned to fly with rockets. And so one of the reasons that it's sort of this old idea that's now getting really revived now is that in many ways the technology has caught up. Batteries weigh much less now. Materials are much stronger. We're sort of able to do stratospheric ballooning now when we couldn't not too many years ago at this scale, simply because the materials and other scientific processes have caught up with stratospheric ballooning, really creating a renaissance in ballooning.
Super cool.
Sounds pretty safe. Yeah. Now, you mentioned you were in the Biosphere 2 project, so obviously you're not afraid to take risks in the name of science. And how has that experience informed this endeavor?
One of the things that Biosphere 2 taught us was small teams can do amazing things, and technical tools can enable small teams to do phenomenal things. So when we were designing Biosphere 2, computers were just coming around. And so partway through the design, literally we're halfway through the design, one day we took out all the drafting tables with pencils and paper, and we installed computers to design the biosphere. And so what happened to the productivity of the team was it skyrocketed. Suddenly we could try things out. We could change designs, and it wasn't going to force a whole redraw of a room full of people with pencils and paper. It was a change in the computer, right? So one of the things we learned was we can make really rapid advances with relatively small teams. And so this is in essence what's creating a lot of new space to happen. You know, these SpaceX and other companies that can launch vehicles now much more efficiently than we could in the Apollo era, obviously, for example, when Apollo was designed with slide rules and paper and pencil. So I think it's that. And when we were designing Biosphere 2, I was spelling the word biosphere down the phone. The word biosphere was not in our lexicon. So that idea also wasn't in the popular mindset. It wasn't in the zeitgeist of people in the world that the Earth is a biosphere, a self-contained, self-sustaining living system. That idea wasn't there. And it's hard to put your mind back in a time when you didn't have an idea. But what Biosphere 2 did was introduce this idea. So by the time we came out from 2 years inside Biosphere 2, everybody had this basic idea about what a biosphere is. And I think that really changed a lot of how we think about the world today. And similarly, I think taking people now to see that biosphere in the context of space is going to be another sort of visceral learning, right? It's one thing to see the data. It's one thing to have an idea, but to have viscerally experienced it in some way, I think makes that's how we learn. That's how I learn, certainly, new ideas, if I can somehow viscerally grasp it.
I would say there's literally no other way. That is one of the big gaps that I think we have. The intellectual idea of something versus experiential, you know, living it is night and day difference. Now, you use the word counterintuitive about that sort of going back to the future, if you will, with lighter than air flight at a time where obviously everything is about speed, about engines, about faster. And, you know, that just doesn't happen normally. And so I'm curious, just from the perspective of the light bulb moment for you or for your team, where does this come from at a time where, again, everybody else is thinking about how to build bigger rockets? You guys are all of a sudden having some sort of revelation that, no, wait a sec, we could go back from heavier than air flight to lighter than air flight.
There's some people say there's very few really new ideas. I mean, human flight to the stratosphere under balloon has been happening since the 50s. The very first time that anyone on the planet developed a life support system to keep somebody alive in fundamentally a near vacuum was so that we could take people under stratospheric balloons to the edge of space in the 50s and 60s. Then the space race happened and we stopped doing ballooning and we went to go to do rockets. So it's not a new idea to take people to the edge of space, but it was very difficult to do with things like the battery technology and the materials that were available then. And so I think the, you know, people kept sort of revisiting the idea over time. And it was really in one of those revisits of the idea that it really looked possible. And that was in the context of, you know, Virgin Galactic was saying they're going to fly, you know, any year now. Space tourism and commercial space was really beginning sort of come into its own in, you know, the late 2010s, you know, sort of 2008, 2009. In that time frame, we were seeing a lot of development. So those ideas were running around and it was really sort of the confluence of this historic way of getting to space as an answer to a lot of people saying at the time, look, I'm not comfortable getting on a commercial rocket. The FAA actually did a study in like 2007 or something. And one of the results of that FAA study was, I don't know if I want to get on a commercial rocket, but I really want to go see the Earth from the edge of space.
Yes, like us.
So it was sort of bringing all these ideas together sort of at the right time with the right team in place that created Space Perspective.
Nice.
So cool. Well, Tabor, we'd love to talk more about this in greater detail, including when you intend to send the first group to space. Are you able to stick around?
Sure.
Okay, well, before we switch to the other side, first, we'd like to bring you a message from our sponsor, the world's number one cloud business system, NetSuite.com.
Yeah, if you're a business owner, and it doesn't matter what type of business, you could be like Tabor. You could be taking people to the stratosphere in a balloon. Woo. Doesn't matter. Pete and I aren't going to tell you how to run your business because, well, we're not business
experts. Oh, no.
And this isn't a business show. But what we can tell you is that you might be making it harder on yourself than it needs to be.
Yeah, that's right. Don't let QuickBooks and spreadsheets slow you down anymore. It's time to upgrade with NetSuite. Stop paying for multiple systems that don't give you the information you need when you need it.
Yes, it is 2021. People, listen to Peter. Ditch the spreadsheets, the old software. Time to upgrade to NetSuite by Oracle. Like Pete mentioned, it's the world's number one cloud business system.
Yeah, and that's because NetSuite gives you visibility and control over your financials, your HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. It's everything you need all in one place, instantaneously. So whether you're doing $1 million or hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, save time and money with NetSuite.
Yeah, and it's tried and true here, people. In case you're thinking this is just sort of, you know, some sort of new fly-by-night cloud system, you've heard it all. There's already 24,000 companies who are using NetSuite right now.
I mean, that sells me. 24,000 companies? Wow. Let NetSuite show you how they'll benefit your business with a free product tour at netsuite.com/whatif. You can schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/whatif. That's
netsuite.com/whatif.
Yes, we'll have more with Space Perspectives' Tabor McCallum in the extended audio version. And if you're watching on YouTube right now, just click the link below to get your full extended audio podcast of What If You Rode a Balloon into Space. If you're already listening to us, well, we'll be back after the break. And if you can't join us on the other side, well, thanks for watching What If Discussed.
Welcome back to What If Discussed. We are with the founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective, a company that specializes in space flight in a very unique way that could be, I think, a game changer in so many ways. So Tabor, we talked earlier about that sort of almost rewiring that happened to astronauts, most famously probably Edgar Mitchell, but really pretty much most astronauts that were in space have talked about that impact, that effect it had on them to see the entirety of the Earth. It's not just a symbolic thing. Like there was more than that going on. How else is this specific type of flight technology going to change things elsewhere?
Well, so the effect you're talking about specifically was I think really first identified by Frank White in, and he published a book in 88 or 87 called The Overview Effect, where he really documented this effect. We've been in touch with him ever since. So, when we sort of had that light bulb moment in Biosphere 2, it was so strongly analogous to the Overview Effect. We've talked with Frank about that, but I think it's really a sort of a change of consciousness, right? I think one of the biggest problems we have right now with space exploration and space settlement, and to the degree that governments are integral to making that happen, is the lack of sort of popular support. Honestly, when NASA doesn't get a funding bump, people don't protest, right? The people don't, call up their congressman. And I think the more that people can have an experience of space, I think that's sort of foundational to governments and other companies creating programs and sustaining programs that explore the moon and Mars and ultimately make us a multiplanetary species that you hear many people, especially Elon, talk about a lot. But that doesn't happen without sort of popular understanding and support. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is create that foundational support of a large number of people, thousands, hundreds of thousands, ultimately, who have been to the edge of space and had a visceral experience and understand that the context that we live in. I think that's one of the bigger takeaways from what we're trying to do, as well as just people managing the Earth with a greater understanding that we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think the pandemic has sort of brought this to light, right? Like we're all on the same Earth and it's going to spread everywhere. But I'm not sure we have the best management tools yet and the best sort of concepts of that. It shouldn't have been surprising. That's part of what we're trying to do. And we're not trying to change people's policy views or politics or religion or anything. I think it's just an experience that people should have and see and then go do with what they will. Mm-hmm. We're just providing sort of a cognitive tool in the tool chest.
It's a perspective change we're trying to get to, I guess, here. In order to get people to experience this interconnectedness and being able to see our planet from space is what's going to do that. It's going to require getting a lot of people on board, literally on board. What are they looking at cost-wise for a balloon trip to space?
So right now we haven't set pricing yet, but it's going to be in the range of $125,000 to fly. The market demand looks so huge that I think we're going to be operationally limited for all space companies together, Virgin and Blue and us and others. So I think there will be lots of demand, but we are looking at ways to bring that price down over time. I think, certainly getting to half that price in time is possible. Wow. And then it's becoming sort of a lifestyle change question for a lot of people. Do I get that new car, that bigger house, or do I decide to go, right? Even at 125, that's steep, but it's, it's a hell of a deal in many respects. So, And there's also organizations that are funding people to go. So we have a partnership with a fabulous organization called Space for Humanity. Mm. And they take applicants, teachers, educators, leaders, artists, musicians, and they're funding people to go. So, there's lots of other ways for people to go. I think every school district should have a teacher who's been to the edge of space, so that everybody growing up has had access to somebody who's had that experience. You can imagine a lot of programs to get educators and artists up to spread that experience.
You're estimating, obviously, about 125,000. What exactly would you get for that price? Like, do you get a white tablecloth dinner in space and pictures and videos? And obviously, you get to go up there and hang out for a while. But is there any other add-ons to it?
I mean, there is obviously a bit of a training program around it. There's, you know, getting people ready for the experience before and after. But really, it's the experience. It's 2 hours slowly ascending, about 2 hours at float, and 2 hours coming back down, splashing down, picked up by a ship and taken back. Yeah, I don't think we have to put a lot of wrapper on that.
Yeah. No. That's the value, I think.
That's the experience. I think people need to be prepared somewhat and you know, sort of cognitively ready for it. But that's the essence of it is just that. Go see the Earth from the edge of space.
But be prepared, Tabor. Somebody will expect a gift bag. It will come up at some point with somebody, I bet.
We'll give T-shirts and a gift bag, I'm sure.
Fair enough. Excellent. So let's say, again, costs, we figured that out. We know that's going to continue to go down over time, and that will get figured out as it always does. What are the other things that do you see as kind of the most obvious problems to solve that aren't necessarily preventing this from happening, but will allow it to be, if not ubiquitous, pretty standard, pretty normal in a decade or two?
So there's two aspects to that. One is the concept of operations being expandable, scalable, and the other is operationalizing the technology. So I'll take those in reverse order. You know, balloons exist, pressurized cabins and spacecraft exist, huge parachutes exist, and they have been integrated together for sort of one-off flights, but not made operational in the sense that we think of a 747 as an operational aircraft that flies day in and day out. So our first big challenge is simply to take these technologies that have been developed to a one-off level and operationalize them, make them so robust, design those operations so that they can fly over and over again safely day in and day out. Then the second is to have an operation that is sort of inherently scalable. So we looked for a long time at flying with a parafoil and landing on the land, for example. And then as we got into flight testing and started working on that, it became incredibly difficult just to find a launch and landing location that were suitably apart from each other in the right orientation, where the Bureau of Land Management would let you land there, and then you precisely land there. Taking that and scaling it around the world was clearly going to be very hard. So that's really what took us to splashing down. There's lots of places in the world where you can take off from land and splash down somewhere. So Florida is great because it's a peninsula. You can go to the east and the west, Hawaii, Alaska. We've looked at some places in Japan, Middle East, Southeast Asia. The Mediterranean has got loads of places you can do that. So this allows us to scale around the world and create a series of experiences that people can have both in different cultures and different sites. So you can imagine going and seeing the Aurora Borealis from the edge of space the Alaskan landscape. Or you can imagine taking a flight from southern India and the capsules brought in with elephants, and you go and you see Sri Lanka and the southern tip of India in a flight, and have that sort of culture mixed with a different view experience. So splashdown, so a ConOps that allows scalability is as important as a technology that can be made robust. And so those are the sort of the two areas to answer your question that have to get developed.
I smell space weddings not too far down the road.
Oh, that'd be cool too. There's so many different things you can do once you're up there and at different times of the day and the year. And
no doubt.
Tabor, you mentioned Elon Musk earlier. As much as I guess you're competing, are you also collaborating at all?
Well, we're not competing at all, and we are collaborating. In many ways, Elon Musk is showing what relatively small teams can do. he's certainly making the idea of space tourism and human space travel and interplanetary travel, a big reality. A flight to orbit for $50 million isn't competing for a flight to the edge of space for $125. However, I think somebody who's done the flight to the edge of space for $125 that can do the orbital flight could be inspired to do so. And we've had lots of discussions with the Virgin, for example. It's much more of a sort of feeding each other experiences and people. Somebody who's done the Virgin experience might want to be up for 2 hours rather than a few minutes.
Hmm.
Somebody who's done our experience might want to go higher and do the rocket ride and feel comfortable to do the rocket ride having done the balloon experience. So really what we find is that all of these things feed each other and help each other. We work, all of these companies work very closely in an organization called the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, which I was chair of until recently for a couple of years. And in this company, in this organization, you know, Blue Origin, Virgin, us, SpaceX, all work together. There's 80 companies in this organization to make things like regulation more effective and trade best practices and safety principles. So really what you find is very little competition in the human spaceflight travel so much as really the cooperation and working with each other. And we use, for example, a lot of the techniques that have been developed for SpaceX to retrieve a capsule from the water, we're able to use. So it's very helpful, actually, to have them there. It's tremendously helpful.
Well, kind of consistent with the overall goal and mission of probably all of your companies to whatever degree. We're all in this together.
Yeah.
And this is pioneering. I mean, that's, you could hardly overstate how pioneering this is.
Oh, it's better than the space race. Like, everyone's friendly about it.
That's a good point. It's very democratic. Yeah. Like, we all have a chance to participate. And this opens up the ability to have that experience that used to be exclusive to astronauts, which it is cool to hear that you guys are collaborating and it makes sense and it excites the hell out of me because I really honestly look forward to, you know, being like, I almost can't believe I'm living in a time where this is honestly like inevitable and imminent and that I could potentially actually experience something like that.
Is there an age limit to it?
Well, let's hope not. I'll talk to Tabor after we finish this to hopefully see if I can help them help us. Tabor, it was really great having you. Like I said, I don't think we can overstate how utterly transformational this, you know, this, your company, but also this time that we're in about the ability to take people into space that way. It's just, again, wildly exciting, super interesting. And again, best of luck on this endeavor, because again, I don't think anybody on this planet won't benefit from your success. So thank you very much for joining us today on What If Discussed.
Thank you very much. It's been a great discussion and look forward to coming back as we make progress.
And before we let you go, sorry, where can people find more about Space Perspective, everything you guys are doing and follow the journey?
At thespaceperspective.com. And you can also sign up to hold your place in line when tickets do go on sale. So go to thespaceperspective.com and sign up to hold your place in line.
Peter, what are you doing?
I'm going to thespaceperspective.com.
Well, I would say that's not fair because I'm obviously not able to jump on right now.
Is there an age limit?
Oh, however, you can reserve up to 8 spots.
Ooh.
And in a lot of people, there's very few people that just do one spot. A lot of them are 2s and 3s. So, you know, you can reserve a spot for both of you to go together.
Wow. Good to know. And to Peter's point, is there an age limit? I'm not guessing. I mean, obviously, you must have to pass a physical, but is there an age limit?
So there's very few physical requirements. There may be an age limit for minors. That's something that the regulatory folks are still working out. But we haven't found a practical upper age limit. We had some questions about an 86-year-old woman a little while ago, and our doctor said she's good to go. So if you can do a commercial airline flight, you can do this. That's really the how stressful it is.
That is super cool. And now I guess that the old guy from Up can potentially join the team as well.
Look at this, Bing. I just reserved.
Peter Smeachin has officially reserved a seat. I'll get on there as well. Thespaceperspective.com. Check it out. It's also provides some cool sort of visual simulation of what this might look like. It's worth going to and checking out. It's wildly exciting. Again, Tabor McCallum, founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective. Thanks again for joining us on What If Discussed.
Thanks.
Thank you. You guys are great.
Well, Pete, I'm not going to lie to you. I am officially excited.
Yeah, you know what? More so than when we started this.
Yes.
Now, it just seems so much more accessible to me now. I mean, obviously, I just booked a group of eight. So you're welcome to join us.
I appreciate that. Excellent. The What If team goes to space. You know what? We should get on that, obviously. 2024 is where they expect this to be. And, you know, these targets move, but that's basically around the corner. And then where could you imagine this being in a decade? Again, who knows? But relative to $50 million price tags and rocket ships and space shuttles going or whatever, which is, of course, going to allow very few people in the world to have that experience. This is, of course, still a big hefty price tag at $125K, but
like you said, he wanted to get, or hoping to get it down to about half of that. And that's within reach for a lot of people.
As a light, like, see, that's the thing. Let's say this exists out there and you're a younger person who knows this is possible. And it's, you know, as he said, you can choose, you know what? Maybe I want to have that Harley Davidson motorbike as my dream come true in my whatever. And that's, you know, no judgment. That could be cool. Or maybe for you, you want to save up for that, you know, wedding anniversary trip or whatever it is, or to bring the family. But it's definitely possible. And I expect in X amount of time, it'll be down to 10, 20, 30K or something like that, which I don't want to pretend is nothing. But for that type of experience, it's a literal once in a lifetime experience.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who will, you know, go out and buy a car, and rather than buying a $30,000 car, they'll buy a $50,000. So if they can make that leap, $20,000, I don't think it's that big of a deal. One thing I was thinking when you were saying going to space, I'm like, yeah, I would really love to go to space, but I think I'm afraid of hot air balloons and just like the, you know, I guess afraid of heights. So it'd be easier for me to go in a rocket than to be like slowly lifted
for a
couple hours. I just thought of that after I've already signed up for.
Now that makes me think, I recall an experience. I'm not a roller coaster guy. I'm not that type of person. But of course, girlfriend back in the day wanted to do that drop zone. Right? Have you ever done that?
I have done that. Yeah. Back in the days when I wasn't so afraid of heights.
So as I found out, to your point, going up was maybe the worst part.
Yeah.
Because with each passing, you know, like let's say meter, I was more and more, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Why did I do this? Yeah. This is terrible. And of course, everybody else is like laughing and giddy and excited. And I was getting angry because I was almost like, let me on. And then of course, once you actually dropped, that, you know how they take pictures after these things?
Yeah.
Whatever. You literally saw a man, like our row was a man, his daughter. And if you're only listening to this, obviously, picture an 8-year-old girl smiling, hee hee, my girlfriend, hee hee, and then me, white knuckled, screaming, holding the thing, and it's all caught in a photograph, and you just see my face like this, ah! And then when we get to the bottom, the carny, and when he's letting us off, and I see them and all the people at the front of the line are all like this, and he just goes, was that you? And I guess I screamed the whole way down at some way that apparently shook the entire CNE. But to that point, I agree that the going up, especially if you have trepidations, might be the worst part, because once you're, this is all in. Once you're going, you're going.
Yeah, they're not letting you off the ride.
No, you're definitely locked, but something to look forward to. And again, I'm putting it on my vision board, step two, because step one will be get a vision board.
Well, we can just go up the street. There's an art supply store, and I can buy you a vision board, put some ribbons on it.
Yes.
And
get
you
some 2021 thumbtacks. Vision board.
Well, okay. Well, we'd like to thank Tabor McCallum once again, co-founder and co-CEO of Space Perspective, for joining us here on What If Discussed today. If you'd like more What If, is it possible that we could give you more What If?
I think so.
Well, Yeah, there is one way. You could sign up for the What If Explorers Club newsletter, get tons of cool science stuff, find out what we're doing behind the scenes.
Signing up for space flights.
Yeah, I was just going to say something like that. But one other thing that we just finished working on was our first ever book.
The What If 100.
The What If 100. Yeah, it's your must-have encyclopedia of imaginations. You've seen it. It's a beautiful, I wish I could show it to you right now.
Literally old school sort of bound book, which is really cool for those people who like the tactile experience and have something on the bookshelf, but also obviously digital versions available at this point.
Yeah, it's a fantastic coffee table type hardcover book. Print and paper, beautiful photographs, amazing artwork, interesting facts, obviously, because you're getting 100 of our favorite scenarios. To get it and to get other items in our What If store, go to whatifshow.com. That's also where you could go to sign up for the What If Explorers Club newsletter. There's so much going on at whatifshow.com. I'd urge everybody to go there. Have you been there, Richard?
I have been there. And I would also, we'd be remiss if we didn't let people know, friend of the show, Michio Kaku, wrote the foreword for the What If 100.
Yes, we made the introduction.
Yes.
Michio Kaku to the book. And yeah, so and he was very kind and generous. And
I think it's the type of thing that speaks to him. Like Tabor said, you know, to us, you know, when we're done, people that work in the field of science and that are literally advancing the entire race understand that generally they've been kind of on behind about three rows of quote unquote celebrities, right? And they appreciate finding out that not only do people support their work, but people are interested in their work. So when they are able to connect with the What If community, I think they really appreciate it.
Science is cool, people. That's it for today. We will see you next time on What If Discussed.